Yeah, you can look it up there. There was Gnosticism, there was Nestorianism, there was the Coptic division, there was Monophysitism, and all manner of things. The biggest split was between the two powerful patriarchs. We can forget Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem, because after the Mohammedan tide had passed over that area, there were only two potent patriarchs left. These other guys were submerged. The offices are still there, I think. But I don't think they've ever meant much since. The big battle was between Constantinople and Rome. And the Bishop of Constantinople would not admit the primacy of the Bishop of Rome, whose full title is what? His correct title is Metropolitan of Rome, Primate of Italy, Patriarch of the West. Those are the original titles of the Bishop of Rome, who styles himself the Pope. Pope means father. In the Greek Orthodox Church, I think the parish priests are called popes, just to get even. At this time, the patriarch in Constantinople styled himself the ecumenical patriarch, or the universal patriarch. The two churches gradually drifted apart as Western civilization drifted away from Byzantium. In the East, the church has always remained a department of the state. It was an instrument of imperialism in the Byzantine government. It made it impossible for this church to spread in the Balkans without getting involved with the Greeks. That's why the Bulgarians insisted on having their own patriarch. They could not admit the primacy of the patriarch in Constantinople, or they would come under the political thumb of the Byzantine government. This is the church which brought religion to Russia, and at one time there was a patriarch in Moscow. He made too much trouble for, I think it was Peter, who got him out of the way, and now they have only a metropolitan in Moscow, and the supreme authority is accomplished by a synod of the Russian Orthodox Church. This church is, I think, a pretty good hunting ground for us, because its teachings are somewhat on the rigid side. At the same time, it's not as rigid as the Roman Catholic Church. I think we can get blue books into the hands of Greek Orthodox people. Well, they aren't all Greeks. Russian Orthodox, Serbian Orthodox, Bulgarian Orthodox. I believe we have a market here.
Don't they teach the atonement just as rigidly?
Yes. They teach about everything that the Romans do, except their ecclesiastical authority isn't quite as tight as the Roman authority. Their organization isn't quite as tight. And there is one difference in the theology. In the Roman Church, they teach that the Spirit proceeded from both the Father and the Son. The Greeks teach an independent processional of the Spirit.
From the Father?
From the Father alone, yes. Well, that's the story of religion.
What's the title of that Greek bishop or metropolitan or patriarch?
Well, the highest ranking Greek bishop is the ecumenical patriarch of Constantinople. But of course, when the Turks took him over, and he became submerged by Mohammedanism, he lost a lot of authority. He no longer had an army, navy, and marine corps behind him.
Well, they still have a very top man over there, don't they?
There is no single head of the Greek Orthodox Church as there is the Roman Catholic, no.
Really?
There's an affiliation of patriarchs. The council idea still prevails.
Mm-hmm. See, I thought that somebody that came over here
with
the head man
or they have the same, they have roughly the same titles. They have priests, bishops, archbishops, and patriarchs. But if the church wants to speak as the church, you have to call a council. Then the council can speak for the Greek church. But the Pope can speak alone for the Roman Church.
Well, that's because the, over in the Greeks, they have the, he's subject to the state, that is.
Mm-hmm.
And the man at the head of the state is the top.
Something like that.
Bill, gee, I found out the number of Romans in the world, and it was a fantastic amount. Are we ever going to penetrate them with this thing?
The number of what?
Roman Catholic.
No.
No, would you like to...
Let's turn it off, but it's 5 o'clock.
Hmm? No, would you
like to... I just love a cup of coffee.
Yeah, and thank you for a wonderful talk. That was wonderful.
Well, they had all kinds among the 12. They had smart ones, and they had dumb ones. They had prosaic ones. They had mercurial ones. They had introverts. They had extroverts. They had large egos. They had small egos. As near as I can see, the thing that made these men interesting was the fact that they loved Jesus. And because they loved him, they played way over their heads for the most part. Let's start to pick up the story if we can. I've got the first six down cold, but I have forgotten which apostles chose the second six, except I know that Andrew chose Matthew.
And the two of the brothers chose the twins.
James and John Zebedee chose the twins, that's right. But I'm a little bit hazy on the other three.
But who chose Nathaniel? Wasn't it Judas?
Jesus.
Jesus chose Nathaniel?
Nathaniel was the last of, was yeah, the sixth
was
apostle.
He was a primary.
You'll recall, I really want to talk to you. I want to talk to you about the 13 apostles of Jesus.
John, right?
No, we'll talk about John, too. That'll make 14. But there's one in there that I always, that means a great deal to me. That was David Zebedee. Because I understand David Zebedee. You'll recall that Jesus had an experience of working with the three Zebedee brothers, James and John and David. And that James and John were very interested in his teachings, his religious theorizing, when he worked in Zebedee's boat shop in Capernaum. David wasn't too interested in Jesus' teachings, although he thought he was a real guy as a mechanic. He was a good boat builder. And you'll recall that James and John really should have been the first chosen apostles. Now, the first disappointment that any of the 12 had in their dealings with Jesus came to these among his oldest friends, because they were out looking for him when he was meditating his problems that lay ahead for 40 days out in the wilderness. They were out there searching for him when Andrew came to Jesus and asked to be chosen as an apostle. Andrew is the only one who took the initiative, and Jesus accepted him. And then you'll recall that Andrew was the first missionary, because he went and got his brother Peter and brought him to Jesus and asked that he be accepted. And this was the beginning of this group of 12. When James and John came down from the hills, they were quite disappointed to discover that the first and second seats at the table had been already preempted by these former apostles, by these former disciples of John the Baptist. And Jesus told them, he said, "Now look." He said, "No, you know full well you're first in my heart, but you also could have been first in the eyes of men if you had not been away on a self-imposed task, which nobody asked you to do, namely, looking for a person who wasn't lost up in the hills." And they were good sports about it, and they accepted his offer. And these were the first four. In many respects, these four men were the most effective of the 12. Later on, when Jesus organized the 12, he did so by appointing Andrew as chief. That's interesting that they called Jesus master and they called Andrew chief. And when he asked Andrew to set up the apostolic organization, he requested that he detail some of the 12 to be his companions, simply to be with him. And Andrew picked Peter and James and John. Hello, Tiki. You see, the Spornagia are interested in spiritual affairs because of their devotion to their masters. Does he play the piano?
He's trying.
Andrew was an introvert, more than an extrovert. He was in many ways the antithesis of Peter. He suffered greatly from a reticence to compliment. And this fear of complimentation was due to his abhorrence of flattery. And it hurt Andrew, I think, in his effectiveness in dealing with groups of people. Andrew was a poor preacher, but an excellent personal worker. His greatest talent was his ability to discover, to see, to discern what a person could do, and to get that person on the right job and convinced that he could do it. Andrew was a good picker of men. He was a good chief. He was a good organizer. I think of Andrew as being something like a veranda deck. Not real versatile like a Melchizedek, but stable like the Rock of Gibraltar. Andrew didn't make very many mistakes. Andrew was seldom at a loss when it came to making an administrative decision. And if you'll stop and consider, most of the administrative decisions in the apostolic corps were made by Andrew. Good example is when the Greeks showed up. Philip didn't know what to do. Here were a bunch of unorthodox people asking to see Jesus. So he took the problem to Andrew, and Andrew handled the problem. Peter, I think, is one of the most fascinating characters among the 12. I met a duplicate of Simon Peter down in Oklahoma City. His name is Alexander. He's pastor of the First Christian Church. He's quite a guy. I went to his services last Easter. Bill Alexander wears a waistcoat, and he wears it well. He's a great big football player type with red hair. His sermon has got every trick of showmanship in the world in it, and it's a darn good sermon besides. I can see the showmanship, but I also appreciated the sermon. It was a good sermon. If we can ever interest Bill Alexander, we've got Peter. We haven't got a Peter in the group so far. We don't have a real orator, a real preacher. This guy might preach, and we might get 2,000 souls interested in the Blue Book, just like Pentecost. And maybe he won't be interested, but I think he is. Peter was aggressive, creative, and impulsive. I've tested men just like Simon Peter. I could draw you Peter's temperament chart. In the aggressive area, Peter would be very high. In the self-control area, very low. And like most darn good salesmen, Peter had a quality we call low social independence. Peter wanted to go along with the group. Peter hated to say no. Peter was very vulnerable to ridicule. This is typical of a really fine, typical sales type. This vulnerability to ridicule, I think, made it very necessary for Jesus to see to it that Peter went through something which was going to act as a permanent bit of education. I think this whole episode in Caiaphas' courtyard was Jesus' technique of administering cowpox to Peter because he saw he was vulnerable to smallpox. And all of the agony of cowpox was much better than the lethal effects of smallpox. Like most creative people of this type, Peter moved fast. When Jesus wanted to wash his feet at the Last Supper, Peter said no, he wouldn't let Jesus humiliate himself. When Jesus explained why he wanted to wash Peter's feet, Peter then asked to be washed all over. When they were nearing after the crucifixion, when they were up in the Sea of Galilee, and they realized it was Jesus standing on the shore. There were 10 of them in the boat. 9 rowed, but Peter jumped overboard and swam. Peter is the sort of a person I think could get me real mad, and I like him real well. Peter wasn't interested in theology at all. Peter was just interested in the immediate and practical application of this to people. That's Bill Alexander's reaction. Bill Alexander could care less about most of this book, but will it help people? That's all he wants to know. Much of the Urantia book would not appeal to Simon Peter, but all of it would have appealed to John Zebedee, because John Zebedee had the theological mind among the 12. John was 23 years of age when he started to follow after Jesus. I can remember that date very well because I was exactly 23 years of age when I first read the Jesus papers. And naturally, chronology-wise, I identified with John. John was the youngest of the apostles. Most of them were around 30. Jesus was one of the older ones. He was 32, and I think the oldest, save Andrew, who was 33 when they started out. I wish you would stop and think about that age spread from 23 to 33. When they were through, John was 27 and Andrew was 37, and they had finished Jesus' public ministry. Jesus was 32 when he took off. Everyone would think he was too young to do anything today. But most of the 12 were younger than Jesus. Speaking of age, it tickles me. Down east, we had some years ago, we had to remove a vice president because he was wrecking the operation of a flat steel factory. And there was only one chap who could step in and run this product division. I'm sorry that this guy was 29 years of age, but that's all the longer he'd lived. And I went back to corporation with my recommendation. And I got terrible opposition from the brass. In fact, he just wasn't going to get the job. And then I turned to the old chairman of the board, who was then well into his 60s. And I said to him, we'll call him Joe. I happen to know the history of this company. I said, Joe, how old were you when you became vice president and general manager of this company when this whole company was about the size of this division? And my pal Joe looked at me, blushed, and stopped talking because he was 28. A year younger than this guy.
Did you know it?
I knew this, yes. It was a mean trick. It was a very mean trick. But it was high time that Joe remembered his past. I think Jesus got these men at their peak of creativity. When I was in my 20s and early 30s, I was pretty sure that I was more creative than most of my elders. Looking back, and from my present vantage point, I know now that I was then right. I have what's left. I have the threadbare remnants of a once creative mind to work with. But it used to be real creative. I think it's a good thing to remember the age group here. We're prone to forget it. John had an overblown ego. He joined the 12. Of all of the 12, he had the best opinion of himself. Contact with Jesus reasonably cured him of his ego. But when he was an old man, and he mustn't be held to blame for this, the old boy was nearing senility. He was almost 100 years old when he dictated the fourth gospel to a Greek amanuensis. And the ego had come back on him at that time. and he did not hesitate to refer to himself as the apostle whom Jesus loved. Well, if he'd said an apostle whom Jesus loved, it would have been all right, because he loved them all. As the papers point out, John was the apostle whom Jesus trusted. Jesus trusted John with such affairs of his private life as he could not personally attend to. When he left for Rome, it was with John that he left his money. It was John who purchased the home that Mary and Jesus' sister Ruth lived in Capernaum. It was to John that he committed the care of his mother when he was dying. If John had an ego, John also had another quality, which was courage. The only other one of the 12, I think, who had a courage that equaled John's was Thomas. John had a chill steel courage. He was unafraid to take a chance. He was the only one of the 12 who was with Jesus. Of course, he was there by invitation. He went right through everything. And the only thing Jesus didn't trust him to see was the indignation which he suffered at the hands of the servants of the high priest. He sent John out of the room. He feared for John's life. James is an interesting character. It's too bad he didn't live, because he was, with Matthew, runner-up to Peter in terms of the ability to handle a crowd. James had a real grasp of Jesus' teachings. He and John both had a temper. You recall? The Samaritans were disrespectful. They wanted Jesus to really invoke his powers and let's blast these beatniks. Let's call down fire and thunder on their impious heads. James liked discretion, not courage. Jesus never commissioned any of the 12 to make private investigations of the life of Herod Antipas, his sex relations, and so forth. This was not a part of the gospel of the kingdom of heaven. But James let his indignation carry him away, divert him from teaching the gospel into taking off after Herod. And Herod had him arrested and tried and beheaded. But he died in such a courageous manner that the person who informed on him joined the followers of Jesus. All of these people died bravely. Peter was crucified, Andrew was crucified, James was beheaded. Only John died of old age. And you recall, it's a sweet picture they paint of the old bishop of Ephesus when he was too old and feeble to walk, and they carry him out in a chair. For a long, long time, in his last years, all he would say to the congregation was, "My little children, love one another." That's quite a long ways from calling down thunder and lightning. These four men, I think, did the most for the early gospel. These were the four men that were closest to Jesus, whom he personally picked. They were all, save James, effective. And if James had been more discreet, he would have been more effective. These were men of considerable ability. Philip and Nathanael, they encountered on the way up from the encampment of John the Baptist. Philip is the type of person who is a very intriguing person. Philip was an excellent administrator. Philip, you'll recall, was the steward of the 12. He was the quartermaster department of the 12. Philip would draw on Judas and would purchase supplies and keep things in order. And very few times did he ever fall down. You remember just before the feeding of the 5,000, Philip was really on pins and needles because he just didn't see where the food was coming from. And that worried him. Philip had no ability to visualize. He was not unintelligent, but he was completely prosaic in terms of creative imagination. Philip could not project. Philip always wanted to be shown. His was not the questioning mind which Thomas had. His was a mind which simply could not put two and two together in the abstract and deduce four. You'll recall the rather touching remark that it was after the resurrection that he went home and baptized his whole family. He had been shown. Philip had a real courage, though. When he met his end, they nailed him to a cross, and he wouldn't stop preaching. And when he died, his wife took it up. And when they killed her, their daughter went up. Philip was traveling with Nathanael, and after he had responded to Jesus' suggestion that he follow him, he too was a missionary, and he went and spoke to Nathanael. I like Nathanael. Nathanael replied with a wisecrack, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" And I think there'll be a perfect parallel as this book spreads around. Can any good thing come out of Chicago? Nazareth was a town with not too high a reputation. It was a communication center, just like Chicago. Nathanael, I feel the closest to of any one of the 12. The questions Nathanael asked are questions which I might have asked, I think. Nathanael was a philosopher. He was no Simon Peter. Nathanael was a teacher, not a preacher. I think he had perhaps the highest intellectual grasp of Jesus' teachings. There were things which Jesus told him, which he admonished and admonished him to tell no man. Jesus trusted Nathanael with the truth about the scriptures. Nathanael had, I think, along with the asset of his humor, Nathanael had a great fault. He was a poor organization man. The story of Nathanael's wasted mission has been of great help to me because, this may surprise you, I pitch for the Urantia Brotherhood. It's very difficult for me to work with an organization. And I think except for knowing about Nathanael, I too could drift off to India because that would be my nature. This is what I would like to do if I were simply left to my own devices. But I don't choose to waste my efforts, and I think Nathanael wasted his efforts. I think when Nathanael left, there was no one left to check Simon Peter. Nathanael, I think, was the last hope of retaining the gospel of Jesus without the rigidity which Abner put into it. I can just imagine how the seraphim of religious life felt. I'm sure they loved Abner, but I know they worked with Paul because Paul was effective and Abner wasn't. I've always been sorry Nathanael went to India because I think if he'd stayed in Jerusalem, he could have done some steering. I think Nathanael could have bridled Peter's enthusiasm and kept something of the original gospel intact. Andrew picked Matthew. And I like Matthew. Matthew was a businessman. I've always been glad there was one businessman among the 12. Matthew was a tax collector. And if you'll recall, in those days, taxes were farmed out as a concession. You paid the government so much for the right to collect taxes. The government had its revenue, and it was up to you to recoup what you'd paid. And human nature being what it is, the tax collector really put a squeeze on the people. Being a tax collector in those days gave one a social position somewhere, I would say, intermediate between a saloon keeper and a white slaver in American society. This was a very low-down occupation. And the others among the 12 weren't too keen about Matthew. Matthew was the only man with any financial means among the 12. It was his job to go out and raise money. It was his job to see to it that Judas' bag was kept full. And many times he wanted to hear what Jesus was teaching. So he would liquidate some of his property and make up for his deficiency in going out to raise funds. This was hard on Matthew. When he would sense that they disdained him as a person of lower social status, he did so badly want to tell them that many times it was his hard cash that bought the bread they ate that day. But he restrained himself, and as the papers say, he did so wish that Jesus knew, and of course Jesus knew all about it. Matthew was efficient. He was dedicated. He was of a type that we would understand as a good, honest politician, but an intensely practical man, a man who could maneuver, a man who could wheel and deal in Texas terminology. As I recall, Matthew also was put to death, wasn't he? What's that? That was Simon Zelotes.
Oh.
Who went down the Nile. I've forgotten. Let's see what happened to Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Unbelieving Jews as fire at the Roman soldiers when the Christ was dead.
He died in Thrace. Thomas was chosen by Philip. And Thomas is an interesting person. It's interesting to me to note that it was Thomas that Jesus paired with Nathanael when he wanted two of the 12 to talk to Rodin. He picked the philosopher, that's understandable, but he backed him up with a scientist. Thomas was moody. Thomas had a fairly unpleasant disposition. I think it's so human that Thomas' wife was glad when he joined the 12, because he'd be away from home more, and this would make life easier on her. Thomas didn't fit into the 12 too well, not for the reason that Matthew had trouble, but just because Thomas could be surly and moody. Peter complained to Jesus about Thomas on at least one occasion. Thomas thought precisely. He had the only scientific mind among the 12. He and John, I think, had the largest measure of courage, because if you'll recall, whenever Jesus' conduct would appear to border on danger, Thomas would argue right to the end that they shouldn't do this. When Jesus would say that they were going to do it anyway because this hour had come, it was always Thomas who said, "All right, let's go and die with him." Philip doubted, but Thomas wanted logic. Philip's questions indicated the inability to adjust to an idea. Thomas' questions indicated the desire for a logical comprehension of what this was all about. Philip's questions were the earmarks of a lack of imagination. In the case of Thomas, it was a scientist approaching the gospel of the kingdom. You'll recall Thomas stayed with him. He made the grade. He died in Malta, just as he was about to begin the writing of the Gospel according to Thomas, which never got written. We have old Simon Zelotes, the patriot among the 12. This man was a real patriot. And I think it's a tribute to Jesus that he held him as well as he did. He was the one that was always hoping that Jesus would sit on David's throne. I've forgotten who it was that got the swords at the tail end. Was it Simon Zelotes?
What, at the defend Jesus?
Yeah.
It was Peter and Simon.
Peter and Simon.
Yeah.
On Palm Sunday, Simon Zelotes was intoxicated because they were going in to take the city over. I can see Simon Zelotes figured, Jesus is going to sit on David's throne and I'm going to be Secretary of Defense in the Commonwealth of Israel. That's exactly the way he had it figured. And there isn't anything wrong with Simon's patriotism. We applaud Americans who feel that way. And if we had an army of occupation in the United States and the Messiah and the Christ had come here, it would have been very difficult for an American to have said, it's not important about these foreign soldiers. You just follow me. Don't worry about the fact that our country is occupied. Simon came awful close to not making it, I think. When Jesus was crucified and the whole thing was over and Simon's dream finally crashed, he simply took to his bed. He was not with the 12, with the 10 in Galilee. And then Simon drew new hope. Jesus had said to Peter, pointing to John, suppose I should not, suppose I should tell this man to tarry until I return. What is that to you? And since John didn't die for a long time, this statement came to be interpreted that Jesus would return in the lifetime of John Zebedee. And if he returned, this meant that the kingdom would come as they'd hoped it would come. Simon believed a myth. Simon Zelotes believed that Jesus' return was imminent. And Simon resurrected his fallen dream and put it back together again and lived a very useful life, ministering to his fellow men, all the time believing in the fiction that Jesus would return and that the kingdom would be restored and that someone was going to sit on David's throne and run the Romans into the Mediterranean. You know, we decry evil and error, but if Simon Zelotes had not believed that error, maybe he never would have lived a useful life. This is a real mixture of good and evil, isn't it? The Alpheus twins were so much alike. They were not sib twins, they were identical twins. I remember when I first read about these twins, it shook me. It shook a little of my faith in Jesus. I just didn't see how he could have accepted those Alpheus twins. This is not how you build an organization. That's true. This is not how you build a business organization. And believe me, occasionally I find an Alpheus twin sitting in a seat of authority, and underneath him I find chaos, real unhappiness, real compression, real claustrophobia among his lieutenants, because he's domineering. But Jesus wasn't building a kingdom of this world. He was building the kingdom of heaven. And these 12 apostles had a function to perform. As we deduce their reaction to Jesus, we can get 12 different facets of Jesus. And each of these men gave Jesus an opportunity to show something of what God's love was like. And if he's going to really show how God loves all men, he needed at least one real stupid apostle, and he got two. And I think maybe it was better to have two, because if there'd been only one, he would have been so lonesome. But the twins could talk to each other. These twins, as the papers call them, men of one talent, I've grown to love as I've thought about them. From my state of initial shock, when I realized that two of these 12 apostles had flunked the Mendel Wasserman test, I got to thinking about it, you know, they did so much better than so many of the 12. When David Zebedee learned about the reports that Jesus was risen and came up to talk to the 12, the twins were the only two who supported him. All the rest of them, all the rest of the smart guys, didn't believe. When the multitude looked at the twins and then heard that Jesus had rejected Matadormus as a member of the 70 evangelists, here's a smart guy with a lot of money, then they knew that Jesus was no respecter of persons. The twins were effective in handling the crowds because they were like so many of the people that were there. They fit. The twins had one quality which gave them charm, real charm. They knew they weren't very much, and they felt cheerful about it. If a person is limited and knows it, that's a charming trait, because he doesn't try to do too much. If he doesn't know it or pretends, well, what? How do they say affectation? Is the ridiculous attempt of the ignorant to appear wise, of the barren soul to appear rich. These twins were wholly free from affectation. These twins teach me something in and of themselves, but their presence enables Jesus to teach us all something about people like this. I hope somebody paints the scene in Celsus Garden when each one of the apostles, save the twins, had talked alone with Jesus, where Peter was the lead man. You'll recall, he said, "Master, it's not that I want to have secrets from my comrades, but we may get into a heated discussion, and you may rebuke me pretty harshly. And if there's no one there, I'll take it so much better." And Jesus says, "Come on, Peter." They went to the far end of the garden, where it was private, and talked. And one by one, through the long night, they talked with Jesus. And finally, all save the twins had this experience. And Andrew went over and, motioning to Jesus, pointed at the twins sleeping by the fire in their clothes. And he said, "Master, shall I waken them?" And Jesus looked down, and he smiled. He didn't sneer, he smiled. And he said, "No, Andrew, let them sleep. They do very well." You remember they asked Jesus very few questions. One time they asked him a pretty profound question, and they were quite proud when they could tell by the expression on Andrew's face that their question had been well answered, but they didn't understand the answer. That's one of the sweetest statements in all these papers. The story of Judas is a darn tragic story. Judas was the only Judean among the 12. I don't think that is a factor Matthew was the only publican among the 12. Judas was one of the two well-educated men among the 12. But the fact that Nathanael didn't betray Jesus proves that it's not education. Judas had an ego, but so did John. Judas could get his feelings hurt, but so could Peter. Judas was not the only one getting swords or conspiring to make Jesus king or this or that. He always had one or more of the 12 as an ally. Judas had a pretty good intellectual grasp of Jesus' teachings. I can see only one difference between Judas and all of the other 11. These 11 men came to love Jesus, and Judas never did. Judas had been spoiled. He grew up thinking in curves instead of trying to think in straight lines. Judas was a rationalizer. Judas was also a great executive. He was a stickler for procedure. He was a good treasurer. He was very honest. Judas wanted to be great in the kingdom. And he didn't understand that greatness is a function of goodness, not of position. Judas wanted status. When he saw that he couldn't get status, the kind of status he wanted in the new kingdom, he decided to maneuver for status in the old kingdom, the commonwealth. And so he went to the Jewish Senate, the Sanhedrin, the board of, well, they were a cross between a Senate, the aldermen of Jerusalem, and the College of Cardinals. It's an odd mixture. It was a theocracy, you know. And he sold Jesus down the river. He expected to be honored with a seat in the Sanhedrin. And we all know what he did when they gave him the price of a good, healthy slave for his betrayal of Jesus. And he took his own life. Judas' maneuverings were well known to the chief of the intelligence corps, who is one of my very favorite citizens, David Zebedee. I'm so glad these papers resurrected him from oblivion. No one told David to set up a messenger service, but he did. David's corps of runners could reach from Damascus to Alexandria. He had relay runners. Now this man was a real organizer. You stop and think how many men it took in relays to cover that distance. This was the first social repercussion of Jesus' gospel, was the organization of David's corps of communication. He was so level-headed. I always think of him when Jesus and the 12 fled a little prematurely from Capernaum, thinking that the agents of Philip Trachonitis were on their heels. You know, Philip was Herod's brother. He ruled, he ruled in Perea. And they're in the boat. It's another picture that should be painted. Jesus and the 12 in the boat, with Philip out there up to his waist, shaking hands with Jesus, saying goodbye. You remember what he said? He said, "Goodbye, Master. Don't let the bigots catch you." And he said, "Don't worry about us. With the relay runners, we'll keep in touch with you. We'll know where you are." And he said, don't worry about me. If they get me, I've got a second in command, even a third in command. The last week in Jerusalem, David used his runner corps as an espionage system. He had a tail watching every move that Judas made. He knew exactly the plot that was unfolding. He and John Mark had appointed themselves to watch over Jesus. John, being a boy, strayed a little from his station because he wanted to hear everything that was going on. John almost got caught that night. David was watching. Where is it, up the Brook Kedron there? It was David Zebedee. David Zebedee was the only human being who said goodbye to Jesus. He was the only one who really believed that Jesus was going to die on this trip to Jerusalem. I think the attitude of the other apostles is well summarized by the comment which either Nathaniel or Thomas said to Rodin, when one said, he even now speaks of his death, some mystical reference to his future glorification. They knew Jesus couldn't die, but David listened, and he took Jesus literally. David sought Jesus out that night, just before he was arrested, and bid him goodbye. And he said, Master, he said, I'll always remember you, and I will always enjoy having worked with you. And Jesus said, David, he said, others have done that which they were told to do, but all these things you have done on your own initiative. That episode was followed when he asked David, he said, have you got a good runner? David said, yes. And I believe the name of the runner was Jacob. And Jesus sent him out on his way to Philadelphia with a message for Abner to the effect that he, Jesus, was about to be put to death, but not to worry, that he would soon see Abner. Here's a man about to submit himself to a few temple guards and a few Roman soldiers. And the tremendous physical power which he could command is just suggested by his promise to Jacob. He said, Jacob, he said, you're going up the bloody way at night. But he said, tonight, do not worry. An unseen runner goes by your side. David's intelligence corps wasn't idle. Jesus hadn't appeared to very many people before David knew all about it. And he went to visit the 12. I guess they were in hiding in the upper chamber of the home of a legend, Mary Mark, in Jerusalem. And I can imagine his surprise. Or maybe he wasn't too surprised when he discovered that none of the 12 save the twins believed that Jesus had risen. And he talked to them, including his two brothers, and then he made that memorable statement in which he said, all right, you boys are the ambassadors of the kingdom, and you ought to understand these things. I'm just the chief of the messenger corps. But I can tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to assemble this corps and send them out with the last message they'll ever carry. And the message which they're going to carry to all the believers is this: Jesus is risen, the tomb is empty, and I'm disbanding the corps. I'd like to see a picture painted of this too. I'd like to see David, I guess it was the home of Joseph of Arimathea, wasn't it? Nicodemus was there. Many of the women believers were there. I'd like to see David with this bunch of runners lined up as he gives them this last message and sends them out on their final trip. This, to me, was the 13th apostle. And I've always been sorry they didn't pick him in Judas' place. And I've always been glad to know how he ended. There was one member of Jesus' family who would have nothing to do with the family conspiracy to muffle Jesus, and that was the youngest member, Ruth. And to me, it is singularly appropriate that David married her. You remember they moved to Philadelphia and were joined there by Lazarus. Nathaniel stopped there on his way to India. Why don't we have a coffee break, then? You know, we're not working tonight, we're playing.
Start a planet, and all the little energies that get controlled, and call them by name, and get us an inhabited world here, settle down to add.
All right.
Build a world for us. Let's
all
make
right.
our own world.
No, take a minute.
Let's derive a planet and achieve destiny, shall we? We won't go into outer space, we'll go into Orvantan space. While this is going on in outer space, the story, I believe, starts just the same as ours, because apparently those nebulae out there are just like the nebulae in Orvantan. But about halfway through the story, it's different. About halfway through our story, we're going to get universe power directors coming in. And this won't be true in the first outer space level. The associate transcendental master force organizers will continue right on in charge of that physical creation. So, as we tell this story, up until the time the power centers of Orvantan take over, I believe the story in Orvantan and the story in the first and even the second outer space level runs parallel. But from that point on, they diverge. And this raises an interesting question about the difference between Orvantan and the first outer space level. I believe that first outer space level is going to be extraordinarily old when we invade it. And it seems to me that it might be possible that it would be physically stabilized before life is ever implanted out there, so that there would be no more astronomical collisions, accidents, and whatnot. In other words, they would have really set the thing up physically before they ever went into it with life and mind and spirit. That's my speculation. You will find no support for that in the papers.
Why wouldn't they have done that in our case then?
Because this was the first one, and they wanted to get going, right? Now they're working on this one, which gives them this fabulous amount of time to get that one set up. The only thing before us was Havona, which was always there. That's why the super universe space level is going to be different from anything before or anything which comes after.
It's experiential.
Yes. It will be different from the four outer space levels in a way that they will not differ from each other, I don't think. I think in the four outer space levels, the differences are more quantitative, whereas here, the difference between us and Avona, or us and them, is essentially qualitative. I think the four outer space levels are far more akin to each other than we are to them, or Havona, or than Havona is to them. And that's because
God the ultimate is evolving all through these four outer space levels. Nothing ends when an outer space level ends, in the sense that the Supreme Being ends when we are completed.
But Bill, the four outer space levels will go consecutively, or one right after the other, probably?
I don't know.
I would assume
the first one first. I'm assuming this.
Finish it and then go on.
Yes, and then the second one second. You see, the in a sense, now here's where our firehouse breaks down a little bit. In a sense, the super universe space level is the first floor of the firehouse, and the four outer space levels are the second floor. And you should ask me then, where is Havona? Havona is on all of these floors. Havona is finite. Havona is absonite. Havona is at least co-absolute.
Paradise would only be on one floor.
Paradise isn't in the firehouse. Paradise is the foundation on which the firehouse is built. And paradise is also the hypothetical roof of the third floor. Paradise is both Alpha and Omega in relation to the firehouse.
Full circle.
Yes. If they could reach the roof of the third floor, they would have attained an experiential paradise value. And I know that the firehouse is built on paradise. Paradise is the foundation of the firehouse. Paradise is before the firehouse and after the firehouse. It is below and above. But before and after is a better word than below and above. I'm going to do some speculating. I'm going to do some guessing. I'm going to tell a story which even the Divine Counselor won't tell, because he knows more than I do. And if he tells it, he's guilty of evil, and I can tell it because I don't know any better. We will now proceed to unscrew the inscrutable. But the papers encourage me to speculate, at the same time warning all of us that our speculations are going to be false. They tell us that our universe romancings are seldom factual, but even so, they may contain much that's truth. This encourages me to have courage along with humility. I think the third source and center has to do with prying loose from the unqualified absolute his grasp on space potency. I think this is a transaction having its roots way back in the deities of paradise. We are told that the third person of deity, not as the infinite spirit, but as the infinite manipulator, does manipulate the forces of paradise. If he can operate on an absolute actuality, I believe he can also operate on an absolute potentiality. This is the logical basis for my speculation. If we have to work out the mechanics of this, if it's not done directly by the infinite manipulator, then I believe it is done by him through the Paradise Trinity, activating the deity absolute, which would cause repercussions in the unqualified absolute. We know that that relationship works because we're so told in the papers. When the Paradise Trinity takes snuff, the unqualified absolute sneezes. Golly, I wonder how that sounds on your verse. I feel almost blasphemous sometimes in trying to get at these things, but I think if your intent is good, you could call God anything and he wouldn't mind, you know?
Sure.
People are that way. Yes, Ruth.
It's hard for me to see why that would be the sequence. Sequence.
I'm trying to get at the unqualified absolute. I know I can approach him. I know I can approach it through the Paradise Trinity, functioning in an unlimited sense, because the unlimited function of the Paradise Trinity is the function of the deity absolute at the present time. And if the deity absolute functions, this affects the unqualified absolute because they are united in the universal absolute. Now, whether it goes this route or whether the third person, as the infinite manipulator, operates directly, I don't know. I think it could be either. I prefer the direct theory. It seems simpler to me. And I think if the conjoint actor, who is the god of action, if he can do things which affect paradise and its functions, then I think he can do things which affect the unqualified absolute and its functions. I believe that the original prying loose of some space potency from the grasp of the unqualified absolute is the function of the conjoint actor. The papers say that if he initiates the motions of space, they can't prove it. But they believe he is the ancestor of motion in space. He's the god of action. And this is action. This is initial creativity. And he personified in conjunction with the original creativity, Havona. I think ever since then, he has been initiating. Only the difference is, in Havona, he also consummated. He still initiates, but his deputies and God's deputies now consummate. I think that through the architects of the Master Universe, the conjoint actor makes known this action. And I think the appropriate architects, the architect in charge of Orvantan, would then dispatch primary force organizers direct from paradise. And I don't think the Ancients of Days know anything about this. And I don't think the Council of Equilibrium up on Universa knows anything about this. This is a transaction at the near paradise level of reality. I think the architects of the Master Universe know all about this. I think these primary Master Force organizers come out here, and their presence signifies that the conjoint creator has already done this. When they arrive, their presence completes the segregation of this quantity, volume, or measure of space potency within the unsegregated remainder of space potency. This space potency came from paradise at the dawn of eternity. It is of paradise origin. The unqualified absolute has been its custodian ever since this eternity event. When the unqualified absolute is the sole custodian of this nebulous stuff of the universes to be, it is called absoluta, or space potency. When the conjoint actor does that, initiates that, which is then completed on the second stage by the primary Master Force organizers, it is no longer unsegregated. It is segregated from a larger whole, and it's called segregata, or primordial energy. Now, these primary force organizers do not have to work in the totality or wholeness of the unqualified absolute. They have now got a chunk that they can go to work on. They have framed something within which they can work and without which, outside of which, they're not going to work. The beginning of anything requires a frame, be it the frame of a concept, the pattern of a spirit, or the segregation of some space potency from all other space potency. These primary force organizers, up until now, have done this by their passive presence. I think the real action took place by Paradise Deity, by the conjoint actor. But now that they have got Segregata, now I think they're on their own. And I think they go actively to work on this Segregata to transform it into the first form of puissant, the first form of emergent energy. Let me get my terminology cold here. I know the main terms, but this A and B, is I have trouble remembering. This segregator is synonymous with primordial force. Primordial means there is nothing before this. But of course there is one thing before this, but it's not anything that anybody can operate on. Primordial force is the first form of force which is manipulatable this side of deity. These primary master force organizers now go to work actively to transform primordial force into something which is emerging from nothingness into somethingness. And that's why the product of their efforts is called emergent energy. Energy emerging from the soul grasp of the unqualified absolute to the grasp of sub-absolute beings. These master force organizers are operating on the second floor of the firehouse. They are transcendental beings. And this is the energy domain of the ultimate, because whenever you're on the second floor of the firehouse, you're dealing with the ultimate. These primary master force organizers continue the manipulation of this energy. And still, the Orbantan government knows nothing of this. Now, out of Uversa, out on Uversa, there is a council of equilibrium. The papers don't say much about this. But this council of equilibrium has to do with the mechanical problems of the maintenance of a physical super universe. This council of equilibrium is the super creatural level of thinking, is at that level, and it's made up of associate transcendental master force organizers. These beings work in conjunction with the Orvantan government. They are the liaisons, so to speak, between the architects of the Master Universe and the government of the time-space creations.